WNST, Towson Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. If you're watching that on our YouTube, you'll see that I got my Fadley shirt on, and we're trying to get the city open for business from everywhere, from Fadley's over to Coco's and down to Fells Point and everywhere else. We cannot wait to get back to Fadley's, and to honor them, I'll be picking up some more of that delicious rockfish and bringing it home with the white wine and the butter and the capers, stuff that's making Don Moeller's wife all jealous about my cooking and my rice pilaf. Also, our friends over at State Fair, we're going to be over with them again, al fresco, hopefully having some chicken and waffles and some of that French press coffee, and Evan owes me a margarita over at El Guapo as well. And last but never least, if I were to change the view from here to, maybe to downtown to, let's say, here where I live, Moeller and Gary Realty would be the answer to all of my prayers to sell my condo. They can find your answer as well at Moeller Homes. Don Moeller, your son is, you said I have a $1 million view here. I said it's half price, currently half price.
Well, there you go. Can't get a better deal than that, can you? And boy, what a show we have today, Nestor. I mean, we've had some icons on Baltimore Positive, but today we have I don't think it's much of an exaggeration to say a legend in the history of the state of Maryland. It is an honor to welcome Larry Gibson, law professor, political organizer, author, historian, professor at the Francis King Carey School of Law at the University of Maryland. Larry, hard for me to believe, been a law professor for almost 40 years there now.
Yes, it's almost 50 years.
Almost 50 years.
Next year will be 50 years.
50 years. So you're not the new kid on the block in the faculty lounge anymore.
I'm the senior faculty member. I've been at Maryland since 74.
Larry, all these years, we still haven't solved justice in this country, have we, huh?
we're getting there.
Well, you know, Larry, we're going to get to all your work on Thurgood Marshall. But before we do that, I want folks to get a sense, you know, not all of our listeners are folks that live and breathe politics and pay attention to Maryland politics. You've been doing this for a long time. You've been fighting, I love the word Nestor uses, justice. You've been fighting for civil rights. You've been in the streets. You've done it all. Take us back to Larry Gibson, the little boy, and how you got this fire started to battle for justice all these years. Where did that come from in your childhood?
Well, I grew up here in Baltimore, in a very segregated Baltimore. My family was poor, so we moved often. I frequently say I had to fight my way into many neighborhoods. And some of these were small black enclaves surrounded by white areas. And so some incidents grew out of that. For example, my job through high school was setting pins in a bowling alley. Never set pins in a bowling alley, which I could bowl as a customer. I got on the streetcar and got off of it at 33rd Street in front of Boulevard Theater. Never could go there. Went to City College. My classmates would talk about places they'd gone that I couldn't. So once I got to Howard University, this was sort of the beginning of the civil rights movement, and I just jumped right in.
Just remarkable. You jump right in. I think for a lot of our younger listeners, I know for my grandchildren, when they hear, and it's so important for them to hear it, when they hear you say, I could set up the pins, but I couldn't bowl. I know you, I could work at the theater, but I couldn't go to the theater. And I know that one of your successes along the way, and one of our connections of many, is my good buddy and my college roommate, Wayne Curry. I always remember the story, Larry, and I know you were instrumental in him becoming county executive. People have heard me tell it before. I'd say, we were sitting at a little restaurant. We met each other the first day at Western Maryland College. Wayne was one of five or six African-Americans, Joe Smothers, Vic McTeer. There were a handful of trailblazers at Western Maryland College. Wayne was one of them. And we're sitting in a restaurant, and everyone around me, it's 1968, everyone's getting served. And Wayne and I are sitting there, and we'd been there long before most of these folks, and everybody's getting served. And I said, Wayne, what the heck is going on? And he just laughs and looks at me and goes, you don't get out much for a city boy, do you? He said, let me educate you, young man, what's going on? You know, and then he gave me the gospel according to Wayne Curry.
That was my good friend, Wade. Look, but see, the one time that I got served during that period made me angry. I was a student at Howard University, and the sitting movement was going on. And we were sitting in restaurants all over Maryland, so I was delighted when we came to Baltimore. Howard's in Washington. Each group had five restaurants we had to go to. So we started downtown. I remember one was called the Harvey House. It was the Eager House. Our last restaurant, of course, we were either denied in or thrown out. And our last of the five was to be the Oriole Cafeteria on York Road. There's a CVS there right now. Well, but this was unlike the restaurants where you had the order. This was a cafeteria. The food was sitting out there on trays. So we come in, about four of us, and we immediately go to the left and start grabbing food. Get to the back to the cashier, expecting to be thrown out. The cashier starts ringing the food up. Well, I had to borrow money. And then we sat at the table. I looked down, and I had this meal, which I had no intentions of eating. It was baked fish. I mean, I'd never had baked fish. We had fish in my family. It was fried. It was brown. It was this yellow baked fish and that salad that has carrots and raisins on it. And so I still to this day call that my salad. So I got angry with them. You know y'all supposed to throw us out of here. What are you trying to do?
I wasn't prepared.
They had heard about the sittings that day, and just for that day, says, well, let's not have no problem, and went back to segregating, excluding us the next day.
Well, when you laugh about it now, and I find it interesting that life can allow you to laugh about that, but if that happened to me tonight, I wouldn't laugh about it. I remember getting thrown out of a place because I didn't have long enough pants and they were sort of profiling. And it really angered me as a 40-year-old that I couldn't even go in and give them money. I know that feeling for a moment. Rage, right? Literally.
Some things stick with you. My family lived in the Govins area in a little block where it was the only block that had black folks. Our closest recreation center was DeWeese Playground. Jump off the Woodburn. My brothers and I and my cousin, who lived with us like a brother, joined the recreation center. They threw us out. But you know what we were upset about? At the time they kicked us out, we were at the top of the ping pong and the pool tournaments in two age groups. That's what we were upset about.
So hang on, they kicked you out. You were allowed for a while?
And then they decided they didn't want any. This is a city, a Baltimore City recreation park, DeWeese Recreation Center. And the reason I mentioned the permanence of it, I recently did a story. I'm trying to remember why I did it, but anyway, I went by there and I still get upset. Oh, by the way, when they kicked us out, we were accepted in across the street. There's something called the Woodburn Center. It was a center for abuse or delinquent children. They had a ping pong table. They had a pool table, and they accepted us in. So the reform school became our recreation center. So we were okay.
How often would the police be involved when they would say leave? I mean,
no, nobody
just get up and leave or no?
No. We ran from the police. I laugh now when people say, well, why did Freddie Gray run? The only thing that Freddie Gray did wrong, he didn't run fast enough. Right. No, he didn't call the policemen have been helpful.
Right. I would say a different time, but maybe not. We'll get into some of that. For those of you just joining us, we are with almost 50 years now, professor at the University of Maryland, Larry Gibson, really a legend in Maryland civil rights and Maryland politics. Larry, one or two more things about growing up, because it's fascinating. When you were this young kid and you were at City or in your neighborhood, who were the figures in your community in terms of leaders or ministers or teachers, in addition to your friends? Who were the folks that made an lasting impact on you?
The people that I remember mostly were teachers. At junior high school, a man named Lou Richardson, a woman named Betty Williams. But then when I got to City to see the school, the Brown versus Board of Education decision came down in 54. And I went to City College in 56. So it's just a couple of years. It was an osis of egalitarianism. I don't remember anything that I could describe as racial discrimination in this school that had just been desegregated. In fact, in my sophomore year, I was elected the class treasurer, and then in the last 2 years as the class vice president. Remember, this is like 700 young men, maybe five, no more than 6% who are African Americans. And so I remember very much Jerry Matheson, the coach, and Ed Novak. There was recently a Sun paper article on an incident that occurred in my freshman year, my ninth grade at City. I went there in an A course. I was running track. I fell and broke my arm. They took me to the closest hospital, which was a Union Memorial Hospital. And for the longest while at the emergency room, they would not set my arm because they didn't serve blacks. Novak was able to convince someone there.
It's 1956?
No, this is 1950, spring of 57. They was able to convince someone to set my arm. I just, in the last year, learned the full story. A classmate wrote a letter to the editor. He remembered this, wrote a letter to the editor of the Sun and published it. And it turns out that what had happened was that there was a City College graduate who was a residence, doctor residence at a Union Memorial. And he came up and spoke with Ed Novak and said, "Look, coach, I'll set this young man's arm." So that was... That was in my freshman year of high school. But City College, I very much remembered not only him, but certainly other professors. And so throughout most of my early year, my real heroes and the people had real impact were teachers.
And were you and Kurt Schmuck? I know you're good friends, have been good friends for many years. Yeah. Were you classmates with Kurt back then?
No, Kurt's 7 years younger than me. Kurt, I was not a contemporary of mine.
But you fast forward, I love a story that Kurt has repeated a number of times, former Mayor Kurt Schmoke, president of the University of Baltimore. He says, "When I ran for state's attorney," and this gets us into your political acumen, which is legendary. He says, "When I ran for state's attorney, our first polls in the spring showed that I was going to get killed. I was down 20 to 30 points. You're laughing." And I said, we're going to get crushed. He said, Larry came back, said he had crunched the numbers. And believe it or not, we're going to close the gap and you're going to win a close election. Inquiring minds want to know, what did Larry Gibson see in crunching those numbers? What did you learn that you've used for decades to be this guy that's seen as a political wizard? What did you see that no one else saw, Larry?
What I really saw was how this man was going to ruin my summer. Kurt came and said he was thinking about running for state's attorney against William Swisher. He had never run for office. He was on a trajectory to be a very successful lawyer. And I did everything I could to try to talk him out of it. Part of it was his interest, but also self-interest. I'd started my teaching career and I was doing lots of travel during the summers. And I had a great trip planned to go to Nepal that summer. And I didn't want to be bothered with any political campaign. You know, primaries then were in September. So part of it was his self-interest, but part of it was my interest. But once he decided to run, well, I couldn't let him lose. And so
that's a basic rule, right? If I'm in, let's win.
You know what? That was the first state's attorney's race. There was another state's attorney's race. There were three mayor races. You know, I didn't get rid of Kurt Smoke until 1999. That's 1982, and that's 1980.
that's hysterical.
What did I see? Someone I couldn't get rid of.
Larry, drill down on that, because to me, what is – I mean – You may have, I didn't see it in my research, but you could write the book on how to win campaigns. What is, if I'm a young up-and-comer that you take a shine to now, and they come and they make the pilgrimage and they say, Professor, I want to win. What have you learned? What's the key to winning, Larry?
Well, first of all, my first citywide election in Baltimore was 1968. But my first political campaign, and maybe the one I learned the most from, was in fall of 1960, Georgia Pearson for homecoming queen of Howard University. The student government office was not the top election. I later was elected the student body president, but the most important election at Howard University was the homecoming queen. And what I learned in that election, actually, we did not elect, there's a tradition of Howard. The homecoming queen was always coming from one or two sororities, aka the sorority of the current vice president or Delta Sigma Theta.
Right.
Well,
that's about it, right?
Okay, yeah. But here's what we figured. I was in a freshman dormitory. Howard had a high attrition then, so a lot of people weren't going to be sophomores or juniors. They'd lost. But for the first year, the largest group of people were the freshmen. So what I figured out were the numbers. Wait a minute. We've got the numbers. We almost won with Georgia. But by the second year, we were sophomores. And we still elected a non-fraternity young lady there. And what that was about was putting together, I guess the word now is coalition, groupings of folks whose interests are not, their focus is not the same, but they're willing to come together for a common objective. That was what we did at Howard University. That's what I did in 1968 with Joe Howard's election. And but I don't know if there's any other formula, but that's what I learned from my first early campaigns. Most often, if someone comes to me, I'm going to try to talk them out of it.
Nestor, can you relate to that?
Larry, I brought this bogus positive project to him. He said, I'll do anything for you, but you can't run for mayor. And I'm like, that's kind of the point, you know, like.
Yeah, but why would anyone put themselves through what is involved? I mean, I admire them to run for office and to be elected. I mean, you're immediately suspect by everybody. The media has its job to do, which is to be negative and critical. As you approach people, they wonder whether you have focused on their interests or your interests. I admire people who are willing to go through that. And my friends, I try to talk them out of it. But if I can't talk it out of them, most often I'm going to try to help them.
And when you don't talk them out of it, they then come back and say, all right, Professor, we're
Wayne
in.
Wayne Fry's another one. I remember saying, Wayne, you're making money, good money. Wayne was a very successful lawyer. I said, man, you don't need this.
You know, Larry, and I'm sure you were involved in talking with Wayne about this. I remember one night, I guess it was, it must have been at that point when it was, you know, Martin O'Malley was talking about running. Wayne was thinking about running. Dutch was thinking about, you go down the list. They were all thinking about running. And they began to float. And I know it was Wayne that floated it to have fun. They kept floating this idea that Wayne Curry might be lieutenant governor for one. And I was at a big dinner one night. A lot of folks you probably know, I know. I said, you know, Curry's going to be LG. And I chuckled and I actually excused myself from the table. I went out to the parking lot and I got him on the phone. I said, why are you doing? And he, of course, belly laughed. He said, it's just a lot of fun. I said, Wayne, there is no planet where you could be the number two. That planet doesn't exist.
You put the you described Wayne. Wayne in politics enjoyed it. It was fun. He was successful. He was productive. He got a lot done. But at the heart of it, Wayne enjoyed every bit of it.
We always remember Senator Mikulski's a good friend of the show, and she loves to tell the story. It didn't make any difference that she was, this very important United States senator. When you went to Wayne, she said, when you got pulled back into that little kitchen behind his office, you knew you were
smoking what he's not supposed to be.
In right. The I
don't know about that.
You know that kitchen.
I know that.
You know that kitchen well. Again, we're with Larry Gibson, longtime law professor, University of Maryland. Larry, before we leave politics and get to Thurgood Marshall, Nestor, you'll find this interesting. Here's a story, Larry, that hasn't been written. And when I heard about it, I said, son of a gun, how do we not know this? You got involved in the presidential election and then the senatorial elections in Georgia. You got involved in Pennsylvania, and then you got involved in Georgia, which ends up with a 50-50 cent. Walk us through how Larry Gibson, law professor at the University of Maryland, gets involved in Pennsylvania politics and then Georgia politics.
Well, I've been involved in a few presidential elections in Pennsylvania for some time because Maryland was often not close, and the outcome in Maryland was preordained. So for both of the Obama elections, I dabbled a little, but everybody knows I put up a lot of signs in the counties that kind of border on Maryland: Delaware, York, Chester, Lancaster County. But and that's what I thought I might do this time. But when I started poking around, I discovered that the Democrats were not doing enough on the ground in terms of sign visibility. And folks know I love political signs. And in fact, as you drove around Pennsylvania, all you saw were Trump signs. And so I decided to do something about that. We put together some money here in Maryland and purchased 20,000 lawn signs, and then contacted Pennsylvanians and sent up a lot of Marylanders, and we put up Biden and Harris signs in 19 Pennsylvania counties, thousands of them, and they now that was a real sign war there because Trump already had the edge, and when we would offer them 1,000 signs of Democrats, they were shocked. Are you going to just give us? What do we have to do? All you got to do is come down here and get them. And then we also sent our own crews around. And that worked. And there was one county, Lancaster County. You know, the reason that the Republicans were visually dominant is the Democrats were selling the signs to people. And the counties were often using them to raise money. There was one county chair, the chair of Lancaster County, who basically turned down the signs and said, well, this is our fundraising mechanism. So I didn't sign crews up there. I went up there myself and others and plastered Lancaster County. So that was the Pennsylvania thing.
Now, wait a minute. Is Larry Gibson out putting up signs absolutely in Pennsylvania?
Absolutely. Yes, all of it.
Yes. I mean, Nestor, you got no words.
This is where I jump before we get to Thurgood Marshall and just say.
Right at the border, you go up Route 1, you go right, when you go from Pennsylvania, from Maryland on Route 1 into Pennsylvania, the road changes. One is light, one is dark. I began right there. I went all the way through Harrisburg, up there. Where's the prison? Lewisburg. Down that there's a, what's that River.
Route 15.
All the way down. I did it on a Sunday morning, and it was a Sunday morning because I knew that they would probably then be up at the, and it rained for a couple of days, which was good. So I plastered Route 15 all the way down to Harrisburg. Then made a right turn at Harrisburg, came all the way over to Hershey. And then I spent a half of a day in Lancaster County where the Democratic Party chair had told me, well, we got our own signs we're going to put up here. There was nothing visible up there but Trump signs. So that was Pennsylvania.
Larry, going back to your experience in the 50s and the 60s and living through all of this, being a little more senior than I, did it shock you that something like Trump happened in this country as a pendulum to Obama?
No, not as much as it has shocked others. I knew that there would be a fairly strong reaction to by a large number of people to the visual of this intelligent, bright black family occupying the White House, because I'd seen it with Kurt Schmoke as mayor. I mean, this is Kurt Schmoke's credentials. That was everything that anybody would want. But at no time did he get more than maybe about 28% of the white vote in Baltimore. And the reason is that there, unfortunately, is a significant number of people who are threatened that their image of their self-worth is tied up into race. And the image of an articulate, bright black person, particular man, in their mind diminishes them, is threatening. And I knew there would be the reaction. Of course, the immediate reaction to Obama was the Tea Party. But remember, it was going to take some strong form. And so now we...
Well, all of it was a front for racism, right? Like all the... literally.
Part of it is, let's take the Civil War. People we say people vote their interests. No, people have never voted their economic interests. At no time was it in the interest of the average Southerner in the Civil War to promote slavery. Their wages were held down. There was a Southern oligarchy that owned a lot of stuff. But to the average person... slavery was against their economic interests. But Lyndon Johnson said that if you can convince someone that they are better than another group, in this case, he said, you convince a white man that he's better than the most elevated African-American, you can pick his pocket and do anything and get anything from him. And now we have the Republican Party understands that. They do lots of things that are damaging. Can you imagine states throughout the South that have terrible health problems turning down money from the federal government? They would rather die and return money to the federal government rather than take it because it's coming from Obama. So I unfortunately recognize that, but I also recognize that that is not universal. Throughout my life, that has become clear. I mentioned that City College. In a few years after Brown, 600 overwhelmingly white students elect me as the class president. And I had a fantastic experience there.
Still couldn't get a meal in Govan's, right?
Still couldn't get the meal in Govan's. The little things, yes. Not only Govan's, to get to the streetcar to number 8, I came up Glenwood Avenue, and right there on the corner was a drugstore that had a counter, that lunch counter that would serve blacks, owned by the family of a City College classmate. This was not universal, quite the contrary. My early influence, Jerome Nathanson, my track coach at City College, a fantastic guy. And throughout, and in this book that I am currently writing, we're going to get to Thurgood Marshall. I'm just finished the Oklahoma chapter. where I point out that although that there were these extreme negative things taking place, there were a lot of good, right-thinking, courageous white people. And there's always been this balance. There's evil and there's good, and we just have to do what we can to help good.
Well, speaking of that, Larry, again, we are going to get to Thurgood Marshall because he's, I think, one of the most compelling figures in American history, and no one knows more about him than you. But before we leave this political topic, I've always been an optimist, but I guess so much of the last few years has made me, you know, more pessimistic. And leading up to January 5th, I kept saying to my wife, she was so excited about Reverend Warnock and John Ossoff, and we could get to a 50-50 Senate. And this was before we knew how difficult Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema could be. But it would have been worse without John Ossoff and Reverend Warnock. I kept saying to her, look, I appreciate your enthusiasm. It's really good. Just understand, we'll probably get to within 3 or 4 points, but we're not going to win either one of those Senate seats. It's still Georgia. We're going to lose both of those seats, and we'll have to do what we can with the minority in the Senate. They both win. They get very little time to celebrate their victory because less than 24 hours, after that January 5th election, we have an insurrection. But what did Larry Gibson see that led him to believe they could win and led Larry Gibson to say, I want to be a part of it? And tell us how you got involved in Georgia.
Okay. First of all, I had no intention originally to do so. After the presidential election, I told my publishers, I'm going back. We're going to finish this book. No more delays. But it was clear that Democrats needed to win both of those elections. And what I saw in the early election stage right afterwards, do you hear that noise? These people are cutting this grass.
That's all right.
Okay. Was that
Warnock, it adds authenticity.
Warnock Ossoff were running good campaigns, but they weren't really campaigning together. And I was fearful that some Democrats would vote for one and not vote for the other. So I designed a sign that put them together. This was not their official campaigns, and raised money here in Maryland. It was all Marylanders. They got 25,000 of a real good quality yard sign. But I also found that even more extreme than Pennsylvania, the Democrats weren't doing enough in the rural areas. The campaigns were heavily on television.
That's a very Democratic thing, right? To sort of quit on red districts, right?
Yeah. But they were not putting up signs. But neither were the Republicans. Unlike Pennsylvania, where the Republicans had been heavily on the ground, in Pennsylvania, the Republican senatorial candidates didn't have much on the ground either. So I got together, I produced and paid for 30,000 signs, went down, and we set up operations. I didn't even know Georgia geography.
It's an amazing story, Larry.
We set up operations. I got them back.
This was 5 months ago, literally, right?
Yeah. Saw that Macon, Georgia was literally in the geographical center of the state, north, south, east, and west. But I ultimately set up operation just below that, a place called Warner Robins. It's like the Glen Burnie of Macon, Georgia, in a catering a place there. And we ultimately had organized sign operations in 119 counties. 109 counties. That was the other thing. I didn't know they had that many counties. I mean, Pennsylvania, 19, I got about a third of the counties in Pennsylvania. You go to Georgia, they have 159 counties.
Netflix. You realize this is a Netflix movie, Larry?
But I contacted all of the Democrats, spent like 3 weeks emailing and phoning the various Democratic operatives in each county. Each county has, even those that are predominantly Republican, have a Democratic chair. And at first, they didn't believe me. I said, look, if I got some signs to you, would you get them up? And they were thinking that I was talking about 10 or 15 or 20. I says, no, I'm coming down there with 25,000. How many can you use? And then and spent 3 weeks getting the word started.
What's the power with signs? Why are you nuts with signs?
Because it is something that works 24/7 for one. A commercial is on here. And if it's on private property, it shows that person and their whole neighbor become a part of the campaign. And even if it isn't, it is a controlling the turf. I've had this argument with campaigns and candidates forever.
Heard, Larry, I want to interrupt and I want you to finish. Because people have said to you over and over, right, Larry, signs don't vote.
Yeah, I
know. Heard. All right, now go ahead. Now answer them.
Television commercial vote, neither does a piece of mail. I understand that people vote, but it establishes the turf and people see these things constantly. And so here's what happened was the Republicans did not respond. And so even in those counties in Georgia that are overwhelmingly Republican and continue would be the vote Republican, the visual impact was of Democratic dominance. And what that did was encourage the 20 or 30% of the Democrats in those counties to get energized. And by the way, this was not a racial thing. I estimate that about 70% of our signs were picked up and delivered by white Democrats. This was not a black thing. This was that's about the racial composition of the state, and that's what happened with the signs. And as I said, the Republicans did not respond. They put up a few billboards. But by election day, from one end of Georgia to the other, I mean from the topmost counties all the way down to those bordering on Florida, it looked like Democratic stronghold. And if you go back and look at the numbers, what changed was not what happened in the big cities. By the way, I didn't put up a sign that I know of in Atlanta or Augusta or Savannah, because that's where the campaigns were active. I concentrated in those rural areas, and the folks there insist that it made the difference.
Counterpunching, as it were, literally.
Yeah, but we kept waiting for the response from the two Republican candidates, and they never did.
Well, Larry, I would suggest that when folks look at that election, there's going to be a chapter on what you did, because while certainly those elections were won in the suburbs of Atlanta, they were won by maximizing Democratic turnout, as you point out, in those rural areas. It might not have happened.
Hey, Larry, maybe the Republican plan was to have the corrupt con man president call the folks down in Georgia and have them find some extra votes. Maybe that was the plan all along.
Find what I need. Hey, Larry, before we let you run, can't let you go without talking about one of the most amazing people in American history and truly a project of love for you. You've written really the definitive work on young Thurgood Marshall, still available out there, folks, in bookstores and Amazon, young Thurgood, the making of a Supreme Court justice. And now you're doing, you said you and the publisher have agreed. You took a couple minutes away from writing. I apologize to the publisher. Tell folks, give us the Four Dummies version of what makes Thurgood Marshall such a transformational
figure. Yeah, I fly out of the airport all the time. What should I think when I pull up?
Okay. And you did that, right? You got that name for him, right,
and
Larry?
Go look at the exhibit. Now, that's Thurgood right there. That's Thurgood right there. Thurgood Marshall was the most important American lawyer of the 20th century, and I didn't coin that phrase. I think Lawrence Tribe did. The impact that he had was in so many areas. And interestingly enough, although his most famous case is Brown versus Board of Education, that certainly did a lot to begin to deconstruct Jim Crow, he regarded as his most important work his voting cases. Beginning in 10 years before Brown in 1944 and dealing with the Texas white primaries, and then in multiple states. And then He, as Solicitor General, defended the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act. He would be really distressed with the current situation. He thought that that was the one battle that we had won, that to be fighting again the voting rights battle would really be distressful to Thurgood. So my first book, as you've pointed out, Don, covered his early years, called Young Thurgood. The book that I'm finishing up now goes from the 1934 to 54, the 20 years, the two decades before Brown. And that's the bulk of his work in the trenches, in the South, primarily, through the Second World War up to Brown. That book will come out next year. But the first book, I'm really proud of it. The foreword to it was it was written by Thurgood Marshall Jr. On the back, there's a blurb from Sissy Marshall, Thurgood's wife, who says it's the most accurate book ever written about her husband. And so I'm very proud of my work there, and look forward to...
Larry, people talk about your, which fascinates me, because, you know, Thurgood Marshall is this guy that people play in movies, and he's bigger than life. And they say, well, you know, Larry and Thurgood had this special relationship. And then there's this anecdote where you get him out of bed one night, and he's in his pajamas, and I want to see if this is true, and you're asking him to come to Baltimore and help school superintendent Roland Patterson. You're getting Justice Thurgood Marshall out of bed. Is that urban legend, or is that true?
No. First of all, we didn't have any long relationship. I was in his, spoke to him only a couple of times. The first time is in 75, when I went to his house late one night to get him to sign this order that you're referring to. It was the first time I'd met him. And I just kept getting lost. And so I get in front of his house, and it's a few minutes after 11 o'clock. And I'm not going to knock on the door of a Supreme Court justice. Well, I did, and he came in his fast bathrobe. And he's the first thing that Thurgood Marshall ever said to me in life was, "Counselor, this had better be a criminal matter." To which I took a chance. I says, "No, Mr. Justice, it isn't, but it is about Baltimore." I wasn't sure what his reaction would be. He says, "Okay, come in." You know, I didn't get out of his house till after 2. He woke up, and it was another young lawyer with me, and he talked about growing up in Baltimore. I'd been led to believe that he just hated the city. Well, of course, he disliked the segregation like I did, but he wanted to know about friends and place, and he was really interested in whether certain buildings were standing. That's 1975. My last time encounter with him was 10 years later. Mr. Clarence Mitchell had died, and the city had decided to name the courthouse the Clarence Mitchell Courthouse. Thurgood Marshall, then on the Supreme Court, came to the ceremony. Afterwards, there was a luncheon in the courthouse. I came up and asked, "Could I take a picture with him?" He said, "Okay." Well, it was taking the photographer a while to snap the picture, just in his camera or something. Thurgood Marshall turns to me and says, "So what am I supposed to do, kiss you?" that is the last thing that Thurgood Marshall ever said to me in life. So I remember the first thing, "Counselor, this had better be a criminal matter, and what am I supposed to do, kiss you?"
Larry, what should we, you've been very gracious with your time. What should we, you mentioned voter suppression, and the horrific things taking place across country right now, and all that they're trying to figure out how to maneuver around Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema. What should we and our listeners always remember about Thurgood Marshall?
Well, I'm first want to respond about Thurgood Marshall, but about this matter that you people should remember that how difficult it was in the past to vote, and you take all of these measures that they're undertaking, they shouldn't frustrate us in our vote. Voting used to be all on one day for about 10 hours, all in the same place. Folks should not let any of these measures, as horrific and as ridiculous as they are and as bad faith as they are, frustrate them in their right to vote. And it looks like that sort of reaction. That certainly was the reaction in Georgia. All of those efforts to stop them to vote produced a record, turnout.
Larry, I don't want to lose that point, because that's a perspective that I don't think we've heard very often. So what you're saying is, don't let all of these efforts that we see in 47 states all across the country, don't let them take away your right to vote. They can't. And if that means you have to go vote and stand in line, then go vote and stand in line. Am I capturing what you're saying?
Yes, through most of the existence of this country, and certainly through most of my political experience, you voted on one day, election day, and that was it. There was no early voting. There was no voting by mail. These are good things. I hope they continue to advance, but we shouldn't get so spoiled in comparison to what the value is of voting to allow these things to frustrate it. And quite to the contrary, use them to our advantage. If we are more energized, then folks who are less energized will do better. So these are despicable, but they need not be fatal.
Fascinating. Our guest is final Larry question. Gibson. Go ahead.
I'm saying, last year I said that one final question, and that is, what should we and the people in our audience, what should they always remember about Justice Thurgood Marshall?
He believed in the U.S. America as to our articulated principles. He realized that we had not lived up to the expressed principles, but they provided the target, and he was just determined to push the country as far along as it could, but to not get frustrated with the fact that what the actions now don't match up with what those principles are. I mean, we have a constitution that's all a principle that all men are created equal at a time when this was not a democracy. Only white men could vote. Women couldn't vote. Blacks couldn't vote. Asian Americans couldn't vote. But still, this was a country founded on an ideal. He said, let's just keep on trying to perfect it.
Larry Gibson, law professor, lawyer, political organizer, and historian, our guest here, and historian of all things Thurgood Marshall. We'll look forward to hopefully having you back on when part two comes out. And I don't know when you know the book is done. It's not like a cake where it comes out of the oven. You're like, oh, it's perfect. At some point, you got to release it, Larry.
No. It goes to the printer the fall of this year. It comes out next year. There'll be lots of promotional stuff.
And you're done with politics till the next election, right?
I am done with politics until I get this manuscript in, and then I will look up and see what's going on, and then decide what if anything I'm going to do.
Well, there if I you run go. For mayor, I'll call you next. All right, you talk me out of it. Works so well for Schmuck.
He's going to give you the same answer I did, Nestor. Larry, I walked him through. I said, "Nah, it's just not a good idea."
I'm growing my hair long. I'm unelectable, Larry.
I have enjoyed this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you for joining
us. Appreciate you. Larry Gibson, our guest here on Baltimore Positive, on behalf of all of our sponsors, including our friends at Wise Markets. That was another Wise conversation here. You can join us at Fadley's, hopefully very, very soon. We're putting together Mayor Brandon Scott to join us at Coco's very soon. We are doing the Crab Cake Tour all over Maryland. Open up some conversations beginning on August 1st. I'll be having 30 crab cakes in 30 days right here in Maryland. I'm Nestor. He's Don. We are WNST. AM 1570 Towson, Baltimore, and we never stop talking Baltimore Positive.